netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out all our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Our guest for this episode is Aram Dunur, visual effects supervisor for Brainstorm Digital. He's part of the team nominated for a VES Award for Outstanding Supporting Visual Effects in a Broadcast Program for Men Who Built America. They won last year at VES, as well as winning an Emmy for their work on Boardwalk Empire. In addition, he's one of our outstanding professors at fxphd.com, with a new course in this January 2013 term titled Paint 205, 3D Plants and Digital Environments. His course is on Vue and SpeedTree, as well as Nuke. Let me read you the course description. Working with SpeedTree, the industry's leading plant creation application, we will progress from the basic concepts of plant design and node-based modeling to advanced procedural techniques. On the way, we'll cover such topics as leaf meshes and fronds, forces, real-time brush sculpting, texturing, managing poly counts and LODs, animated wind effects, and physical plant mesh interactions. Sounds like a great course. So let's join now Mike Seymour speaking with Aram Dunur.
So thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And congratulations on the nomination for the VES Awards.
Thank you.
So this is obviously a pattern with you, with episodic television, of winning lots of awards. You've had a very good run recently. This VES nomination is for The Men Who Built America. Do you want to tell me about that project?
This is a series for the History Channel about some of the richest people in the history of the USA, like Carnegie and Rockefeller. And there was quite a lot of period augmentation in there. There was also a sequence about a flood. It was one of the biggest disasters in the history of the USA that was caused by, we can say, greed. a dam that they tried to make wider so that one of the rich people could go over it with his carriage. And because they messed up with the dam, it collapsed and basically drowned an entire city. And that's a true story. And of course, there is no way you can shoot this for real, so we had to recreate this in CG. And there were lots of matte paintings and extensions. Quite a big work for a History Channel documentary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this I think the particular episode that you have the nomination for is episode 2, which is Bloody Battles, if I'm correct.
Yeah, and that episode includes some of the bigger shots we had, including all these flood shots that I was talking about. There are like 4 different shots there that are flood shots that were real flow simulations and matte painting. We basically had to recreate everything, including the dam. So we shot in an area that has a dam, but it doesn't look like the original one at all. So that was a big work there. We also had a shot there. That's for another episode, the Panama Canal. So that was another big one. And a number of other matte painting shots, including workers working on that dam that we had to kind of move around and recreate the entire environment around them. So it was very interesting work, and we're very proud to be nominated for this, especially since, you know, this is a smaller budget kind of project, unlike HBO's Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, because you're known for doing this kind of environment work, and the Boardwalk Empire that you're referring to won in the VES Awards actually twice, right, for outstanding models as well as for outstanding compositing.
Which
was terrific. And, of course, also a primetime Emmy. Tell me, the people that were nominated with you on Men Who Built America, you tell me about Glenn, Matthew, and David?
Glenn is one of the owners of Brainstorm Digital, and he was the visual effects producer on this show. Dave is our compositing supervisor, and Matthew is our lead environment artist, matte painter, and they're all, you know, extremely talented. And I feel so lucky working with these people, because when you work in a smaller studio like ours, because you don't have that many people to work on things, you really have to rely on talent and the ability of different artists to kind of switch from compositing to matte painting to 3D work. So these people have to be much more flexible and quick in a way. In larger studios and, you know, bigger places, you have people that specialize in a very specific task. But when you work with a small team, you really have to have each one of the people that really, you know, go out of their way to produce these kind of shots with a, you know, lower budget and very tight time frame. So yeah, it's great to be working with these people. Just terrific.
And in fact, Brainstorm Digital, this is the third straight year in a row that you've been nominated for a VES Award, hasn't it? So what was that in the first year?
The first year I wasn't here yet. That was for the first season of Boardwalk Empire. And they received, I think, two VES awards for environment and modeling, and also the first Emmy award. So last year, that was the second Emmy award for Brainstorm Digital, and another two VES awards.
So
the second season.
And so talk to me about the sort of the company itself. There's about a dozen or so people, isn't it? It's not particularly large.
Well, there is a core group of people, and then we expand, you know, depending on the amount of projects we have or the type of specialists we need. But we have a very good core group of people, matte painters and compositors, who really do tremendous work.
And we shouldn't imply that you're only doing episodic work, because I believe that Brainstorm Digital is also doing stuff with Rob Legato for, I believe, an upcoming Martin Scorsese, as well as I think you're working on Delivery Man, is that right?
We're currently working on a number of feature films. We're working on The Heat, which is a comedy. We're working on The Delivery Man. We are going to start working on the movie you mentioned, The Wolf of Wall Street. That's a Scorsese film. And we finished a very big job on a movie called Low Life, which is not out yet. James Gray is the director, a really beautiful movie, periodic, that happens in New York City in the 1920s, a drama with Marion Cotillard, the French actress, and Joaquin Phoenix and Jeremy Renner. And we're, you know, really looking forward for it to come out and to see. There was some really, really challenging work done there.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have done amazing work. And, for example, The Heat you just mentioned, you're a visual effects supervisor on that. That's a great-looking comedy. I'm looking forward to seeing that. Looks like it'll be a riot.
It's funny. It's funny.
I wondered if we could circle back on earlier in your career, because I'd like to come back and do a bit of a comparison and contrast between episodic television and feature film work, and certainly how a company that's not a huge mega facility with 1,000 employees works so successfully. But to do that, I think we need to set the stage of some of the stuff that you've done in your career, because you have a really amazing track record. And I guess did that start at ILM, or did it? Where were you pre-ILM?
Oh, I was a musician for about half of my life, and I wrote music for theater, and it had nothing to do with visual effects. And no, I'm serious. And I've done that for, 15 years or so. I studied composition here in New York at the Juilliard School, and I was completely into that and had, never thought that I'll move into visual effects. I started downloading, software, demos of software, and looking at books, and started falling in love with this, but it was more of a hobby. And then I really liked Vue. That was, I think, version 2 of Vue, and I started creating landscape images and posting them on the internet. And at some point, that got some attention, and eventually, I did some small-scale VFX work and architectural renderings, more of a side thing, while, making you know, earning money mostly as a musician. And at that point, they offered me to come over to ILM Singapore to work there on view and matte painting. And later on, it became mostly compositing. And for me, it was an incredible experience because, you know, to be able to work in an environment like ILM, you know, on big movies and complicated VFX shots and working with, you know, amazing VFX supervisors and artists. And it was almost, I can say, like my school in a way. I learned so much there that I think when I came out of there and moved over to New York, I had a lot of knowledge and experience that enabled me to work in smaller studios and kind of use that.
Now, for most people, a chance to work at ILM would be terrific. But, you know, you're a little bit, if you're new and you're in Singapore, you don't necessarily get to pick what projects you're on with quite the sort of, I guess, you know, power that a senior supervisor does. So you arrive at ILM, what, in around 2007, 2008, was it?
2007, yeah.
Yep. And yet, in the first couple of years that you're there, your screen credits are Iron Man, Indiana Jones, Star Trek, Terminator, Transformers. I mean, that's a pretty impressive first couple of years of credits.
Yeah, look, I mean, these are the kind of movies that ILM usually works on. And, you know, as I said, it was an incredible experience to work on movies like that. And, you know, I learned fast and I tried to, you know, to advance as much as I could. And that was an incredible opportunity to do that.
Was most of that work environment work then?
Eventually, most of the work was actually compositing and some environment work.
And what were you compositing on?
Yeah.
What were you compositing with? What application?
It was Shake. It was Shake. So the move to Nuke happened just as I was leaving there and moving over to New York.
And you moved to...
But it was all Shake.
Yeah, and you moved to Framestore in New York, right?
I moved to New York and I worked at Framestore for about a year. Again, working on Framestore New York, they do the majority of the work they do is commercials, like most of the studios in New York. Well, it's changing now, actually. There's more and more film work being done in New York. But they had a smaller department, a film department, and some of the projects I worked on, we were working with the bigger Framestore, you know, Framestore London on their projects, and some were done like Salt. We're done here. And again, there's a great team there at Framestore, and they have a very strong 3D team that, you know, from the commercial department, Houdini guys. So again, it was a great experience there. And then I moved over to Brainstorm.
Now, Brainstorm is, as I say, able to bridge this world of doing both episodic television work, which is really high quality, obviously, but also feature film work, working with amazing directors. The company isn't that big. I mean, what do you put it down to? Is it that the company is known for one thing? Is it that the company has just been super lucky? I mean, there must be something that you think in addition to just... Because, I mean, look, you guys are obviously talented, but there are companies with talented people that have... That have, well, let's face it, gone out of business. You guys are thriving. What do you put it down to?
Well, the two owners, Rich and Glenn, they both started out as editors in Hollywood, and they worked on a lot of movies, and they got to know quite a lot of people, directors, editors, producers. So I think that's part of the thing. You know, it's a lot about being connected to other people and having worked with other people before, because usually that's how it goes. If you've worked with someone in the past and you like their work, you'll go back to them. And I think it's their ability to, you know, communicate with these people and keep in touch and be around. And then I think it's also, look, some of it, I wouldn't say it's luck, but things are changing in New York now because of the tax credits. There are more and more productions that want to do their post here in New York or shoot the entire film. Something like was happening in Canada, you know, 2 years ago and still going on. So there is some kind of a little bit of move from LA to New York, and there is quite a number of very good companies here that have a lot of experience in commercials and some film work, but Brainstorm has never done commercials, so we're not doing commercials at all. So I think that might be another part of it. When you have a crew that is used to work on film and TV, it's a different workflow. It's a different attitude, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but I mean, people would argue that it's a different workflow between episodic television and features, not least of which is when you're working on a show that is television-based, you tend to have, not only are the productions longer, because obviously they run as a series, but they overlap, and there's a sort of a rolling nature of them. And I guess at the end of the day also, what tends to drive a feature film is the director. What tends to drive a television series is normally the show runners or the show producers. I mean, do you find them the same or do you find them very different?
I think VFX in TV is going through a major change in the last few years. I think you used to think of like, okay, if you want to see really good visual effects, you should see a movie, and if you are watching TV, it's going to be, you know, less than ideal visual effects. And I think that has changed a lot. There is a budget issue. Of course, the big movies, the big VFX movies have a much bigger budget. But I think the quality in general on TV of visual effects really went up. And I think we have very strong competition, you know. If you look at the VS or the Emmy, you see that awards are now are given to shows that have really high-quality visual effects. And if you look at Boardwalk Empire, for example, first of all, it's shot on film. So you're working with the same medium that you would be working in on a movie. It's a different resolution, so it's HD, but it's shot on film. And the whole attitude toward the VFX is very similar to film. A lot of attention to detail, you know, everything needs to look right. The only thing that's a bit different, as you said, is the time frame. Usually less time to work on, usually smaller budget, and because it's episodic, it can drag on through you know, a long period of time, but you'll end up doing the VFX quite fast. So that's the biggest difference, but I find anything else almost the same. At least the way we work here, we treat TV the same as we would treat a movie in terms of the attention to detail and the quality we expect from the artist. And I think it comes from production too. And even on a series like Men Who Built America, which is a History Channel documentary series, we really try to give our best within the limit, you know, of the budget and the time frame. Never treat it as something that is, you know, on a different quality level than a movie.
Are the tools that you use the same? I mean, is there any difference in the workflow from a sort of technical point of view?
It's exactly the same. I mean, okay, you don't have an amorphic format when you do TV, but other than that, you know, Nuke is our compositing software, and Maya is a 3D software, and Photoshop used for matte paintings. It's the same, and workflows are the same. I think that drawing a line between film and TV now is a bit artificial.
So in terms of resolution, the resolution difference between 2K and film, HD and film is, you know, not much. I mean, a 1920 by 1080 versus a 2K frame is pretty
right.
Similar. There normally is sort of, you know, a different pipeline, especially shot on film. Though a lot of Sus being shot digitally. You said Boardwalk Empire was shot on film. But did you treat that as like an HD once it was transferred? You wouldn't have bothered with, or did you bother with it as a sort of a Cineon pipeline?
It's scanned in HD, so what we get is already HD. I'm not sure if it was the same on season one, because I wasn't working on season
sure.
one, but season two and three, the scans are done as HD.
And then,
but apart from that, yeah, it's a scanned film, so it's the same process.
And then the men who made America, was that shot digitally or shot on film?
No, that was shot digitally on the Alexa, and we love working with the Alexa. I'm sure you do too. And ideally we would have liked it to be shot on the high res, you know, raw format, but that the expense is much higher because you need special gear for that. So it ended up being shot HD, and that's a bit of a difference. Yeah, when you work on film, you have larger resolution. For example, the James Gray movie was anamorphic shot 4K, and we've done all the visual effects on 4K plates.
Right, and The Heat, which is coming out in April, was shot presumably just normal 35.
Yeah, that is normal.
And that would be the sort of standard Cineon pipeline.
Yeah, they were all Cineon. Also, the Low Life movie was Cineon, but working 4K, you know, it's a great experience. It's a great experience and a horrible one at the same time, because as a compositor, you know, everything, you have so much more pixel space to work with. For example, if you're doing green screen extractions, they come out much nicer because you have twice as much detail in there. But on the other hand, when you render out stuff and when you have to store all the frames for hundreds of takes, that takes twice as long and takes up twice as much space. But I think eventually more and more films will be worked on 4K as we get, you know, more RAM, more storage space. It's just it's fantastic to work on a large resolution like that.
So talk to me then, if we've established that the tools are fairly much the same, talk to me what those tools are. If we could use The Men Who Built America as an example. So you've got a lot of environment stuff there. Walk me through the primary tools that you would use. For example, the dam busting sequence or environment that, that's something similar.
Most of the environments, yeah, they were matte paintings, and for that we usually use Nuke Photoshop. They were partially based on photographs or plates that were shot. We also use SpeedTree for adding some tree movement, because a lot of these matte paintings were very static because they're based on photos, and adding just a little bit of, you know, here and there some trees moving really makes it feel a bit more alive without going and shooting plates for that. So we use SpeedTree for some trees, and then the actual flood and the dam break, that was Maya and RealFlow.
Right, because I'm speaking about the right sequence. The dam busts, and you have like a large sort of fluid sim, well, decent fluid sim of the water rushing down and stuff. And then for the matte paintings that we've described, the ones that are in Photoshop and stuff, for those that aren't so familiar with the show, the camera doesn't tend to be moving around a lot. It's not like a sort of a shaky cam kind of thing, is it? It's kind of a, I mean, there are camera moves, but it's a fairly reserved camera palette. It seems to me from watching the show.
Yeah. I mean, so some of these shots were constructed from scratch entirely. So we had nothing to work there, and the whole environment was sort of built as a matte painting. But it's true, and we're actually starting to work now on a new mini-series by the same team, same producer for Discovery Channel called Gold Fever. This time, there's much more of a 3D move to cameras, which, of course, you know, requires us to track this. But I think that adds a lot of dynamics to the shots.
There is a green screen used on the show. Do you have any advice on how you work as a supervisor with green screen, or do you tend to sort of dispense? I mean, I imagine you need to put green screen in, because while you can do roto and stuff, it's much faster to just pull keys.
It is. I mean, green screens come with their own set of problems. you know, ideally, if you could roto anything, everything, that would be a clean, you know, no spill solution. But that's a solution if you have a whole army of roto artists working day and night. So practically, yes, you're right. It's I usually try on set, you know, and in the pre-planning and pre-production, try to get green screen for every shot that will need some kind of removal in the background or changes. But, you know, a lot of times you have to deal with natural elements. There is wind, there is shadows going on the green screen, there is dust. So it's not easy. And, you know, a lot of, I see this in a lot of places, people consider green screen comps as easy, as opposed to CG comps that are considered hard. And they say, oh, that, you know, these are just green screen shots. But I think green screens are hard. Because it's not just about getting the perfect extraction and the right edges. It's also the problem that usually the light doesn't match. And unless you shot, you know, the background exactly at the same place and same time that you shot the foreground. But in many cases, you have to comp something on a completely different background and light, and it's hard to make it look right. It's very hard. And you can't just relight it like you would do with a CG or 3D element, and you know, and the spill issue, especially with green screens. So I don't consider green screen shots easy at all. I think they need a lot of expertise. And sometimes, you know, it's easier to just comping a CG element. You've got a clean mat, everything is clean. You just drop it in there. It was hopefully lit the right way to match the shot. Green screens are tough, definitely.
So you started your VFX career, you mentioned, with Vue, and your team, and you still use Vue today, don't you? Do you want to comment on where you think that program's at?
Look, Vue is a unique and really amazing software. I fell in love with it when it was version 2, and that was like another kind of Bryce at that time, an alternative to Bryce. But it grew, and I think that around version 5 or 6, when they introduced the ecosystems and the procedural terrains and the spectral atmosphere, that made it a really, you know, a very useful and a powerful software. And still doesn't quite have any competition. I mean, I think that by now it's probably the only dedicated natural environment tool that exists. The use of Vue varies because a lot of time you'd want to use real footage for matte paintings just because it looks real, because it is real. And as a supervisor, I have to take into account time and money when working on a shot. And a lot of times, a simple 2D solution, if it works, things projected on cards, is good enough. And then you tend to shy away from full 3D solutions. But there are times where you have to have it in 3D, and that's where Vue really comes in useful. Because the fact that you can create, you know, a very, very highly dense, you know, dense and detailed environment, say like a jungle or a forest, very quickly, and then light it correctly, that is something that is very hard to do when you're grabbing all kinds of pieces of footage and trying to create a coherent environment, but each one has sort of a different lighting and sort of a different color space. So even as a matte painting tool, just for creating some, you know, big backgrounds, it's really incredibly useful.
So talk to me about stuff that's, because you talked then before about the speed tree. There's also the sort of plant factory stuff. I mean, how do these two products work together?
They don't work together. They do the same thing. So they are in a way competing, but of course it's unfair because the Plant Factory is not out yet. And, you know, Vue users have been waiting for years for Vue to have, you know, a really powerful kind of plant design and creation software. That you could modify trees a little bit in Vue, but it never really was it. And since trees are and plants are so important in a software like Vue, you really wanted something. And they've been working on it for quite a few years now, developing a very impressive software that will work with Vue but can also export to other programs. And in many ways, it's similar to SpeedTree because they are both procedural programs, which is the way you really want to go when you model trees and plants. You know, modeling the normal way. I mean, you know, pushing and pulling vertices just really doesn't work on complex things like trees. So they are both procedural. They have a lot in common, but they also have a lot of differences. SpeedTree is an amazing software. I mean, it started out as a sort of a games-only tool, real-time tool, and was only rented per project at a very, very expensive rate. And then they created this version called Studio, which is very affordable for VFX works. And it's really a very, very smart program, very nicely designed. Well designed, and you know, I fell in love with it, and I think the students at the course now are feeling the same.
The course you're referring to, of course, is the one that you're running over at FX PhD.
Yes, the 3D plants and digital environments course.
It's interesting that SpeedTree has a nodal kind of representation for the generation. Because it really is just like a very powerful way. Because you want to add variation, you also want to add similarity. You want to have like them look like the same species, and obviously have sort of similar properties. But without the variation, you just get something that looks completely electronic.
Yeah, I mean that's part of the idea that if you create things procedurally, you can define sort of thresholds for variation for every parameter and every element. So then you know you click a button and it just kind of, it even looks like a dice, which is what it is. It throws a dice and changes the numbers according to the thresholds you've set, and there you get another tree which looks similar but is different. And that's, you know, that's very powerful. And, you know, I wish they had something like that for cars. You know, you model one car and you get a Fiat and then it changes into a Ford just by rolling the dice. But, you know, man-made objects work differently. And I was always fascinated by nature, by sort of recreating nature. That's why I guess I was attracted to Vue in the first place. I always find it more interesting to create natural things in 3D or CG than man-made things like, you know, like cars or machines or spaceships. Also because I like nature.
Yeah.
But it's very, very hard to do that. It's very hard, and it never really feels quite successful. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, it can be computationally prohibitive to try and get the kind of level of detail you want, or at least it used to be much more. The SpeedTree is multi-threaded. I mean, how do you find the speed from an, you know, an operational point of view on using things like SpeedTree and, for that matter, Vue?
SpeedTree is phenomenal. I mean, you get a 3D preview that looks looks, you know, great, has all the detail and everything in there, and you hardly feel a slowdown even when you get things really, really heavy in terms of polygon count. And Vue for a number of years now was able to, you know, to let you manage scenes that have billions of polygons. That's like you said, it's a requirement. If you don't have that, you can't really, you know, you can't really get the complexity of nature. The thing is that SpeedTree was originally designed for games, so there are a lot of shortcuts and cheats to get things very low poly, you know, like using billboards for leaves that always face the camera. But the good thing about it right now, and that goes for the Plant Factory as well, is that you can choose your path. You can create very low poly stuff for games and real-time applications, or you can go very heavy if you're doing visual effects and you need like a hero tree in front. And you can afford having, you know, billion, you know, I don't know if billions, but hundreds of thousands of polygons on a big tree because you're rendering it, you know, it's not real time.
Well, I guess for me, the thing that I like about all of this is that when you look at one of these digital environments, or let's call it a matte painting, though that's probably not doing it justice, it just adds such complexity and such production values that it really can make, because obviously you know, tend to use it on a wide establishing shot more than anything else, but it can really set the tone for a scene and add immense production value. And obviously you guys have been using this entire pipeline incredibly successfully, and congratulations on the work you've been doing, because I think it's outstanding. It's great to see a company like yours succeeding.
Thanks a lot.
Good luck with the...
I hope it will continue.
Good luck with the VES Awards, and congratulations also on the Emmys. It's been a phenomenal run, and it's great to see a company straddling, as Brainstorm does, both feature film and episodic television. From Brooklyn.
Yeah, Brooklyn. Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, guys. This was podcast number 240. We've been doing this for quite a while. One of the ways we continue to do these is with the help of people like you, people who have joined our FX Insider membership program. FX Insiders get access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produce a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And also, like I mentioned at the beginning, check out our sister site, fxphd.com, where Aaron is also a professor. FXPhD offers extensive online visual effects training at affordable prices. That'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.